Unbelievable, isn't that? I mean, if I had that in front of me, word for word, I couldn't even come close to doing that. So, you know what? I think it's just a great picture of what moms are capable of doing if they really put their minds to it. So everything she's saying about and actually being able to do that, that's awesome. Hey, you know what? I know you already kind of got on our feet for Kelly, but let's have all the moms. If you're a mom, grandma, stand up so we can recognize who you are and say our thanks to you. You know, one of my favorite passages in the New Testament where it talks about the Apostle Paul, who I think I always saw as kind of a harsh guy. He was about truth and about what was right. Writes one time that when he was with them, he was like a mother, like a nursing mother caring for her children. You know, when he was looking for an image of real care and compassion, that's what he went to. It's such a beautiful picture of what moms are. So now we're going to kind of come full circle in a little bit at the end of the service and come back to moms and to be able to again live in a moment of thankfulness for all you moms. But we're going to continue our series now called Magnet. And the idea of Magnet is this. What would it be like to have a personality or a way of living, a character that is magnetic, which means people are drawn to you? And when you think about a person that you're drawn to, what qualities do you see in their life? And here's the, you know, if we're honest, and the surveys show this, when you use a word like Christian and ask people, what do you think when you hear Christian? When they do these surveys, generally, most of the answers are negative, unfortunately. In fact, they wouldn't use magnetic. They would say they kind of repel. So we're missing something. If you're here and you would identify yourself as a Christian, it doesn't apply to everyone, but why is that the general feeling? And, you know, here's the amazing thing. Jesus, when he was here on earth, was magnetic. And if the story is true, and I believe it is true, this was actually God who came into his creation in the form of a man and lived among people and lived, for most of his life, a pretty normal life. So why is it that, because you read the accounts in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the historical account, that people were drawn to him. It was magnetic. And in fact, here's the more telling thing. The people that were in the worst shape, regarded as the worst sinners in their culture, loved being around Jesus. And so the question that, when I think about that, I ask myself as one who would identify myself as a follower of Jesus, are people drawn to me? Or are they repelled? So we wanted to flesh out some characteristics, some qualities that we would see in Jesus' life and ones that are taught in the Bible and kind of examine that and say, what is this like and how do we get there? How do we learn from Jesus if we're going to follow him? And so I would, you know, knowing that there's probably two audiences here, there's those who would identify themselves as Christ followers. I would say the challenge in the next 30 minutes for us is to look at Jesus' life, what he taught, how he lived, and to say, honestly, am I living that way and can I learn from him how to live that way? And for those that maybe are here investigating Christianity, you're not sure what you believe about Jesus, to see him for who he is, to see the attractiveness of Jesus, and maybe that would be another step in your journey to understanding Jesus. So here's how we're going to do it. We're going to look at a passage. I don't know if you know this, but actually thankfulness is not talked about very much when you look at the life of Jesus. In fact, there's only three times that are recorded. I'm sure there were more, but only three times that are recorded when Jesus actually gave thanks to God. And all three of them involve food. And actually, two of them are two almost identical miracles that took place, where Jesus took some bread and some fish and he multiplied it, but before he passed it out, he raised his eyes to heaven and gave thanks for the food, and then the miracle happened. And then the other one is at the end of his life when Jesus was with his closest followers the night before he was crucified, having what we call the Passover, the Last Supper, he broke the bread and he gave thanks. Those are the only three times recorded in all the Gospels where Jesus gave thanks. Yet I do believe it was characteristic of how he looked at life, and hopefully we'll see that together in the next few minutes. So what we're going to do is look primarily at the miracle story, but not focus so much on the miracle, but a dialogue that happened between Jesus and his disciples. And then at the very end, we'll come to that last passage in the upper room where he, the night before he was crucified, he gave thanks as well. See what we can learn from that. So I'm going to be looking at a passage in Matthew 14, and parts of it will go up on the screen in just a few moments, but I want to kind of set the stage for you. How many remember the story like from Sunday school, or you've heard it before, where Jesus took some loaves and fish and multiplied it to a large group of people. Okay, so many of us, some of you don't know the story at all, so I want to give you a little background. Jesus had been real busy for a long time, and it was time for a break, and so he got in a boat with his disciples. They went across the lake. They went to a private, solitary place way out in the country where no one could find him. But guess what happened? They found him. So a large crowd came, and Jesus welcomed them because he had compassion, and he was with them all day long, serving them. And it got to be late in the day, and we're told in the story that no one had anything to eat all day long, so they really were hungry. So before the sun sets, the disciples come to Jesus, and they said, you know what? We got a problem here. There's no stores around here. There's no provisions. We got to send the people away before it gets dark so they can find some food somewhere. So that kind of sets up the story that we're going to look at. In Matthew 14, here's what Jesus says to them. He says, they do not need to go away. You give them something to eat. Now, let me tell you, the count says there were 5,000 men. That's how they would do surveys or, you know, census. But the women and children were there. And so even a conservative estimate would be, picture the Palace of Auburn Hills. 20,000 people probably were there, spread out over the hills. Been there all day, out in the open, hungry. And Jesus says, no, you don't need to send them away. You feed them. You give them something to eat. Well, here's how they respond. We have here only 5 loaves. Of bread and 2 fish. Bring them here to me, he said. And he directed the people to sit down on the grass, taking the 5 loaves and 2 fish, and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. And the end of the story is that he fed all of them. Everyone had something to eat. Now, in that story, there are 2 words that I want to focus on. It's really all I want to do is just 2 words. The first word is the word only. Did you catch it? He says, you give them something to eat. They said, we have here only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Only. And what the only is about is what we have is not enough. And so I think they struggled with gratitude and being thankful. The other word is a word that Jesus spoke. When he had the people sit down, he took the 5 loaves and 2 fish, and he looked up to heaven, and he gave thanks. He didn't pray for a miracle. He didn't ask for anything from his Father. He looked up to heaven with just a few loaves and a few fish and said, thank you for this. So think about those 2 perspectives we're going to talk about today. There are 2 ways of living life. There's the only way, only, I only have, we only have, and then there's the thankful way. One looks at what we don't have, one looks at what we do have. And I believe the secret to understanding how we can be people who truly have gratitude in our heart is learning to break away from the only way, which is the way we live today. It's our culture. It's our world. And learn to live in the thankful way. It's not easy, but it's possible. And Jesus, in this passage, it's kind of subtle, but he shows us how to do that. So let's go ahead and dive into those 2. By the way, I don't know if you do this, but when I read the Gospels, when I read the stories about Jesus' life and the things that happened, I think I get the most out of it when I try to identify myself in the story. Like, if I'm there, where am I? Who am I in the story? And I think there's 2 different groups you can identify in the story. I think you can identify with both of them. And I think that's going to be our way to find how to be grateful. So here we go. Back in the story now. So here they are. This is the only way. This is the only principle or perspective on life. It's kind of a way we look at life and kind of a way that we tend to live. And it's so permeated in our culture, this only perspective. And what happened to them is kind of understandable. Jesus said, you give them something to eat. Now, imagine you're one of them. You know, make this real. This is a real story, real people. Try to picture this. You're looking at 20,000 people, and you just got there out in the wilderness by a boat. So how much can you bring on a little boat? When Jesus said, you give them something to eat, you feed them. And Luke, the account in Luke provides a little bit more detail because Luke was more of a detailed writer. There's a little bit more exchange that happened. He actually said, well, how much do you have? And so they went and looked first, and then they came back. Now imagine when Jesus said, go find out what you have. How much do you have? They got to be thinking as they walk away. I can hear Peter and John mumbling like, well, what does he think? You know, we didn't bring a caravan. We didn't bring trailers. We didn't bring camels loaded down with but they went and looked. And imagine the people that are there listening as well. Like, where's all this food going to come from? So they go get what I'm sure was their lunch, their dinner, because it's only 5 loaves and 2 fish. And they bring it back and they set it before Jesus and they say, we only have. So we can cut them some slack, because when you're doing inventory, you know, if you're going to have family over for dinner and then 10 family members show up you didn't expect, you're not going to have enough food. Well, they were only planning on the 13 of them eating dinner together, and now there's 20,000. That's a pretty big gap, wouldn't you agree, in terms of how much is available? So they stand there and they say, we only have. So I'm going to kind of let them off the hook. But on the other hand, I want to say, when I read those words this week preparing this message, that word just jumped out at me. I felt like God was saying to me when I read that, Craig, that's how you live. It's too much of the time looking at not what I have, but what I don't have. Because only, when you say I only have, you're not looking at what you have. You're really looking at what you don't have, because if you had more, then you wouldn't say only. And so what we tend to do is live as if the stuff we have is not enough and we need more and we need newer and we need better. And if we're honest, most of us struggle with this, at least at some time. You know, my son, who's 15, I asked him if I could tell this story, and because I always do that with my kids, and he said yes, but he wasn't going to come to church. So he's at another campus, I think. But he for years and years, he's wanted an Apple computer, a laptop, because his older brother and sister had them. They got them when they graduated from high school. And so he's 15. He's been for years and years wanting a computer like that. And so he saved up money from cutting lawns and whatever else he could do. And his bank account swelled to about $600. That's, you know, a lot of money for him, but it's way short of what you need for a computer. So he finagled things until this Christmas. Every gift went toward the computer. And so Christmas morning, he opens up one gift, and it was no surprise. It was a MacBook Pro. Am I saying that right? You guys? Okay, MacBook Pro, which is a really great addition. You can edit video on it. And he opened it up, and it was really great. It was awesome. It was unbelievable. He had this MacBook Pro. He was so happy, so fulfilled. He wasn't saying, I only have this old PC. I only have this, that. He says, I've got a MacBook Pro. A month later, he calls me into the kitchen. He says, oh, Dad, look at this. They came out with this MacBook Air. I don't know if you know about the Air. It's 3/4 inch thick when it's closed. And it only weighs 3 pounds, and it's got this amazing screen with resolution and how fast it is, whatever. And he didn't actually say anything, but I watched him. He's looking on the screen of his MacBook Pro at this picture of the MacBook Air, and I could see the wheels turning, and I could hear his thoughts saying, this thing I have is a piece of junk, you know? It weighs 5 pounds. It's 2 inches thick, you know? I got to lug it around. It's like breaking my back, you know, all those thoughts. But you know what? It's not just 15-year-olds that do that. And he told me last night when I said I want to tell the story, he says, oh, I love my MacBook Pro, and I wouldn't even want the MacBook Air if someone gave it to me, you know. I don't know if he really feels that way, but it probably made him feel better to say that. But the reality is that is the message of our culture. How do you think advertising works? Advertising works by creating, and if you're in advertising, maybe I don't have this right, you can yell at me later, send me an email. But I think, as I watch it, I think they're trying to make me discontent with what I have. Like, life isn't really full or rich or complete until I have that. And so I look at what I do have and I say, I only have this. And when you think that way, then what you have will never be enough. And that is not an attractive way to live. That it comes out of us in all kinds of subtle ways. And we envy people. It spurs on greed. And there's a lack of gratitude. And there's a sense of entitlement. And if only, and you were living in the future instead of the present. Because there's not gratefulness. There's not gratitude there. You know, moving to New York, I tell you, is just a surreal experience getting ready to do this. Because at this stage of life, I have a house that's 2,150 square feet, and it's got a basement and an attic and a garage, and it's got stuff everywhere. Because when you get to this stage of life, your house is like a museum. It is, isn't it? It's all your family history. Are you still in Japan?
No, back.
You're back home. Welcome home. Sorry, just a little. That was a commercial. I didn't even see who was here. Nice to have you back again. I'm leaving, though. But so we actually, and we're going to an apartment. We haven't found it yet because you got to wait till you're ready to sign the lease immediately in New York or it's gone. But it's going to be probably around 1,000 square feet. And so I realize that we can't keep hardly, you know, even all of our furniture, much less all of our stuff. And I don't want to put stuff in storage. I just don't want to live that way. So we started really this winter trying to go through and begin to deaccumulate. And it turned out to be a lot harder than I thought. And so about a week ago, I jumped into the Craigslist thing. You guys know Craigslist? I actually started it. It's me. I'm the Craig. I'm the Craig of Craigslist. Not really. But I started putting stuff for sale on Craigslist. And how many of you have done this before? This thing is unbelievable. Like, you post something, and within an hour, you got like 10 emails. Where were these people just, you know, I'm waiting for a chair. Oh, there's a chair, and they email back. But here's what's been happening. Since then, it started, I think, on Monday or Tuesday this week. I have perfect strangers coming out to my house and taking my stuff. And it turned out to be a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. I didn't realize the attachment I had to stuff, number one. But then also I realized, like, everything that I have has a story behind it. And until you do this, you don't realize that. Like, the chair was the first thing to go. It was a leather chair that I put in the corner of my den. It's where I get up in the morning and I sit down with my cup of coffee and my Bible journal. I pray, I read. It's a quiet place. It's a leather chair. There's no way it's going to go in our apartment. So that was the first thing I advertised. And yet as I helped her load it in her van and she drove away, and I went back and there's a gap in my den now. I was remembering when I had to have that chair because we got a desk set. It's kind of like, you know, with shoes with women. I should do this on Mother's Day. You know, my wife has a lot of shoes, but it's because only certain shoes go with certain kinds of clothes, and I still don't get it exactly. But, I got a nice desk unit, which also is I have to sell, but it didn't look complete without that chair there, so I had to go get the chair. And I remember going out to Art Van and finding a sale on this leather chair and just had to have it. And here's the thing, I'm just going to be totally honest with you. As I've been selling stuff, I realized how many bad financial decisions I've made over the years because I think I only have mindset. Where I would buy stuff before I was really ready to buy it, I would charge it, believing I would pay it off, and sometimes I did and sometimes I didn't. In fact, the last thing that went yesterday, there's still lots of things, but my last sale of Saturday was my tent for camping that I bought about 10 years ago, used it 6 times because my wife doesn't get camping. She doesn't understand why you'd go out like in the woods with bugs and snakes and sleep on an uncomfortable bed. Why is that fun? So I grew up with it, so I understand why it's fun. But so she only went once, and my kids went a few times. But here's the thing. When I set it up in the backyard to take a picture to put on Craigslist, and then someone bought it right away. But I remember when I was shopping for the tent, because we had a tent, but it was canvas, and it leaked sometimes, and it was old, and I needed a new one. And then I used it 6 times. And then someone buys it for $40, you know, about a fourth of what I paid for it. And I realize that I've lived a lot more in this only point of view than I realize. And so to begin to recognize that and to say, where do we find gratitude? Where do we find thankfulness? I believe as long as we hold on to this idea and we buy into the lie that I got to have more than I have right now. I have to have a newer. Dave Wilson doing this message last night at Troy was talking about his trio, how when he got it 3 years ago, how awesome it was. Well, I'm sitting there with my stupid little cell phone. I've never even gotten one of those trios or Blackberries or whatever. But technology especially, there's always new, there's always more, and it creates a discontent that I think eats away at our soul. It's hard to be grateful when you're thinking, I only have. We only have. Well, back to the story. Jesus takes them in a totally different direction. And think about now, what's happened here? They brought these loaves and they brought these fish and they set them down at Jesus' feet. And if you're in the crowd now, so maybe the first person you identify with the story is maybe the disciples. Maybe you struggle with this, I only have, as you look at your life and don't realize how much you do have, because he only looks at what you don't have, not what you do have. But now they bring the loaves and the fish there and you're in the crowd. So now identify with the crowd if you can. If you're up near the front of this gathering, you've heard Jesus say, we're going to feed them. So you get pretty excited because you're going to get a meal. And you're waiting for the trucks to pull up because you know how many people there are. And so when they come with the baskets and the couple, just the bread and the fish, if you're like in the front row right here, you get fed. If you're 2 or 3 deep, you're out. You know that. You guys ever go to wedding receptions? If you ever go with me and sit at my table, I will be the last table. Happens every time. I've tried it. I've said to perfect strangers, I'm sitting at the table, I say, hi, I'm Joe, oh, I'm Craig, whatever, we'll be last. They go, what do you mean? Our table will be last called to eat, because I'm always at the last table. God's trying to teach me something, I think. But you sit there, and you know, when you're at the last table, they also have the line somehow go right by you. So they do it on purpose. They bring their big plates of food, and for some reason, everybody's like putting double, triple portions of everything on. So you're sitting there thinking, I know when I get up there, there's going to be no food left. But at least that really good salad's going to be gone. Now, it almost never is, but you think that way. That's what they're thinking. I think they're thinking, and the disciples especially, you know why? Because that was their meal. They brought that on the boat with them because they always had provisions. So they're going to give their lunch away, feed only a few people, and they're probably thinking a riot's going to break out. Because you know what? If you don't have enough in a large crowd and the expectations are there, then people get mad and they get angry. And I've seen that happen before. I've seen that happen in India where we brought stuff and it wasn't enough. And I was in one riot a couple years ago in India after the tsunami where we bought supplies and there wasn't enough for everybody. And they were angry. And there were fights and there were broken bones and it was just a mess. That happens. And so that, you know, this looks like a dangerous, scary situation that's unfolding here when you promise food and you got only a little bit. So what does Jesus do? He says, bring them here to me. And he directed the people to sit down on the grass, taking the 5 loaves and 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Thanks. That's the other word. Now, it's one of those things that you just kind of fly by when you read the Bible sometimes, but stop and ask yourself for a moment, why would Jesus give thanks? It doesn't say he asked God for a miracle or, you know, please make something happen here. He looked up to heaven and he gave thanks. He was thankful in that moment. There was still only 5 and 2. He was thankful then in that moment. Why? Why did he pray? Why did he give thanks? Just contemplate that for a moment. Here's what I think. Who was in the crowd? Matthew says, and Luke agrees, that these are people who came who are broken, sick, in need of some help. And Jesus, all day long, even though he was tired, because he was trying to get away for a break, had compassion and healed everyone that came to him for healing. Imagine that. Whatever sickness you have right now, whatever pain, or someone you know, if they would be healed, if they would be touched. You know, in India, people there are very spiritual, and it's mostly Hindus that come to us for prayer. They line up 100 deep, and I don't believe I have the gift of healing or anything, but I'll pray for people, and I make it a point, everyone that comes for prayer, is to look in their eyes, get eye contact, to see the longing and the hurt and the hope that maybe God would do something, and we actually have seen some amazing things happen. Well, Jesus has done that all day long with hundreds, probably thousands of people. The physical touch of another human being that he loved and valued and healed them. And now it's not, their legs aren't working, their eyes won't see. Now it's just appetite. They're just hungry. They've been there all day with no food. And I think Jesus knew what was going to happen, that they're all going to be, their needs are going to be met. And so he looks up to heaven and he gives thanks to God. You know, just take a moment and think about what really matters in life. What really matters? What is worth really being occupied with? Is it the stuff of life? Or is it not people? And as long as your basic needs are met. And sometimes it takes experiences to teach us this. A couple weeks ago, my car broke down. And I couldn't get started, so I pushed it off the side of the road on a Friday. And I had to go somewhere that night. So, you know, got a ride. And I got up early Saturday morning. And I was driving back to where my car was with jumper cables, hoping somehow magically overnight it got healed and the car would start. You ever do that? Wishful thinking. When I raised the hood, I even put my hands on it and prayed. I did. God, please. Because it felt like an expensive breakdown. Okay, you know that? And it turned out it was. But here's what happened. I had a total paradigm shift on the way there. Because I'll admit to you, I didn't sleep very well that night. I was worried about money, worried about the car. How are we going to fix it now with everything else going on? I can't afford to be without a car because our transmission went on another car and we got rid of it because in New York we're not going to have a car. So I'm just praying. I'm anxious. Try not to be anxious. I get a text message, and the message was from Seth Stark, who is our video director. About 3 weeks before that time, his daughter, who's 3.5 years old, her name is Eve, was diagnosed with leukemia. And I went and met him at Beaumont Hospital, and I visited him a couple times, and it was so hard to see her. They're putting tubes in her and just stuff. But the prognosis was pretty good that she's going to recover from this, but it's going to be a hard couple years, really. And she had been home now a few days, and that was good. She's, you know, doing well. Well, the text message as I'm driving about my car filled with worry was, Eve had some problems last night, and we had to go back to Beaumont. We're at Beaumont. And I tell you what, in that moment, I didn't care anything about my car. If it could have made Eve better, I would have driven it into the lake and walked away from it. It's like, who cares about a car? What really matters in life? And I think when the reason why Jesus gave thanks, you know, Jesus never owned a home, never owned anything as far as we can tell, ever. And yet there was contentment and gratitude in his heart, because what he did is he valued people and he provided for them the basic needs of life. And Jesus pointed us to that. He said, if you want to really live, then don't seek all this other stuff. In fact, I want you to see this in Matthew 6, a passage where he talks about the basic stuff of life. He says, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after these things. By the way, pagan, that was not a derogatory term. It sounds, when you say pagan today, but that simply meant a person who's living with no belief in God. So someone who does not believe in God runs after these things. And what he means is they worry about them. They worry about the daily stuff of life. And he says this. He says, but your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness and all these things. The basic stuff of life. It doesn't say MacBook Pro or a new car or a BlackBerry. He says all these things, the basic stuff of life, will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. And you know what? If you live with I only have mentality, you will have anxiety. You will worry. I do. If I'm living with an only perspective on life, then anxiety goes along with it. It's the twin sister of that. But when you learn to trust God for your basic stuff of life and you say, I'm going to be content with that. In fact, Paul would write later on, I think he was thinking of this, these words of Jesus. Paul said that if you have food and clothes, to be content. That's a pretty low list of stuff, wouldn't you agree? In fact, how many ate within the last 24 hours? Okay, some of you are not raising your hand, so you're hungry. Hopefully someone's taking you out to lunch. Okay, this next one's easier. How many have clothes on right now? All right, two of you up in the balcony, the risers, did not raise your hand. Are they naked up there? Okay. But here's what the simplicity. Again, he's saying that if you have the basic stuff of life, then be content with that and learn to seek after God, because that's worthy of your kind of anxiety. Be worried about getting to know more of God. Pursue that. Make that the focus of your life. And as you do, God's going to provide for your basic needs, and you can live your life then with gratitude. You can have thanksgiving in your heart because he provides for you. And this story, I believe, in Matthew 14 is a story of God's provision. He doesn't do miracles like he did there necessarily to put food on our table, but every time you sit down to eat, a miracle has happened. God's given you the ability to generate the basic stuff of life. And you may have a junk car out, and you may be in a rented apartment, and you may not have much stuff by comparison, but if you go into the only thing, if only I had, there's no contentment there, and there's no gratitude there, and there's no thankfulness there. But if you can go into the basic thankfulness for the basic stuff of life. You know, how many of you, a lot of you pray in your homes growing up? We had six kids in our family, and my parents, so there were eight of us, and we would rotate who would pray before a meal. And you know what prayer really is? Prayer is just hitting the pause button, saying we're running through life, we're busy, we're eating, we're probably going to eat fast, but let's pause and just take a moment to take inventory. Okay, everything's not good. There's struggles, and we're hurting in some ways, but you know what? I'm glad we're eating right now. And I'm glad I'm eating with you as I sit across the table. Now, with my brothers and sisters, I didn't always feel that way. In fact, you know, when I was a teenager, you know how teenagers sometimes, I don't want to insult any of the students here that are in high school, but I went through a phase when I was kind of a smart aleck. And when it was my turn to pray one time, we said a prayer in our family, God is great, God is good, and we thank him for this food. And I realized that didn't really rhyme, so everybody bowed their head, and I said, God is great, God is good, and we thank him for this food. And everybody, my brothers and sisters all looked up and knew I was in trouble, and I was in trouble. That's the last time I prayed that way. But you know, it could become a rote thing like that, but you think about it, it's simply doing what Jesus said. I got food, I got clothes. Can I learn to be content with this? Can I learn to lift to heaven just briefly and say, God, thank you. Thank you for the people in my life. Thank you for your provision. Well, real quickly, I just want to finish with this. So he prayed twice when he multiplied the bread, and then he prayed with thanksgiving at the very end of his life before the crucifixion. And he sat with his closest disciples in an upper room, and he took some bread, and he looked up and he gave thanks, and he broke it. And then he said these amazing words. He said to his disciples, and they didn't get what he meant then, but he said, this now is my body. It represents my body that is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. Jesus wanted us, he wanted them, and he wants us to remember what happened. Why? Because I think that is the foundation to gratitude. Now, again, for those of you that are following Jesus and you believe, you put your trust in him, just think for a moment what that story means. It means that you are loved with an outrageous love, a scandalous love. It means that the God who made you came into his creation and exchanged his life for you so you could be set free. There is nothing you fear because death cannot defeat you. Sin has not defeated you. Jesus took all of that, defeated all that for you. And so you are living as immortal people. So when your physical body dies, you live forever. That is why it's called good news. That's why it's called the gospel. The gospel is a God who exchanged his life for you to set you free. You didn't deserve it. I didn't deserve it. It's a free gift given to us. We live under that truth every day, employed or unemployed, sick or healthy, with a huge house or no house, whatever we have, that doesn't change that. Nothing can touch that. That's the truth that we live under. And if we could push the pause button, you know, when he said, do this to remember me, he was saying, pause, stop, think, remember, recall, embrace it, feel it again, believe it again, live like that's reality again. And I think, you know, we do it like at Kensington, we do it together corporately once a month, typically only at our midweek service at our Troy campus. We call it New Community, first Wednesday of the month. We do it together. But he said, as often as you do this, remember me. And I think we ought to, every time we break bread to eat at our home, hit the pause button. And the reason we pray is we're saying, God, thank you that you're making, you know what I need. And it's demonstrated right here on the table because there's food here for me. And also thank you for the food that's for my soul. Thank you for what you've given for me. Thank you that you gave up your body, allow your body to be broken for me so that I don't have to go through that. That's the good news. And that, I believe, is a basis for contentment or gratitude. And I, you know what? I'll come back a year from now and tell you how I did. But I was really nervous about this, getting rid of everything and getting down to a small apartment. I hope when I get there and I have far less than I have, I realize that I still have as much as I ever had that really matters. I have a God who loves me, a God who believes in me, a God who is patient with me, a God who forgives me, a God who gave his life for me, whose body was broken for me. I have a God who has given me a forever. And that's the basis for gratitude. How can I not be grateful? How could I ever say to God, well, that's not enough. I only have. No, whatever I have in this life is just a bonus. And to be grateful for that. And if you're someone here who is investigating Jesus and investigating Christianity, I want to apologize to you for all the times in my life and the life of followers of Jesus. You know, we're imperfect people. And we're never going to be perfect. And we're not sometimes any more grateful than the guy next to us who doesn't have anything to do with God. But that's not the way of Jesus. We're trying. We're on a journey trying to learn this from Jesus. When you look at his life, and that's really where you should start, not with me, but him. When you look at the life of Jesus, you see here's an amazing way to live. We can learn from him. Let's pray. Father, I pray in these closing moments that we will hear your invitation to this kind of life. I'm certainly hearing it now from you. To just let go of the worries and the stuff that doesn't matter in the long run. To look around us to see what we do have and to be thankful. And even in our lack and our want and our struggles, our physical illnesses, all that we do experience in this life, because this life is hard at times. It is for all of us. That we would also in that moment meet you, meet your love and your provision and be so grateful for that. Teach us to be thankful. We pray this in your name. Amen. You know, as we said at the beginning,